Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schlom. A few weeks ago, I heard about a documentary called The Biggest Little Farm by filmmaker turned farmer John Chester and his wife and partner Molly. Its premise intrigued me because I'm fascinated by the idea that our agricultural system is terrible for the long-term health of not only our environment, but also for us as the human inhabitants of this tiny oasis in the vastness of space.
You will see things that you did not see before.
So with the help of our assistant producer, Ellie Johnson, I arranged for a screening of the film and fell completely in love with it as well as its message that farms can be more than the monoculture industrial wastelands that dominate U.S. agriculture today. That they can be productive places that help feed the communities that they are a part of and be profitable. But it isn't easy.
Complexity, diversity, all supporting and enhancing each other, you will see a web of life.
The farm story has been one of triumph and heartbreak as John and Molly Chester and their staff, along with their mentor and friend, Alan York, set out to turn a 200-acre piece of depleted, mostly unproductive orchard and farmland in Ventura County, California, into a place that's now an agricultural and ecological marvel. Filmmaker and farmer John Chester joined us from Apricot Lane Farms in Moore Park, California, to share the story of making The Biggest Little Farm, both the film and the actual working farm. John Chester, welcome to Blue Dot.
Well, thanks for having me on.
It's a beautiful film, and I'd like to start by asking you the Captain Obvious question about this documentary. Why is it called The Biggest Little Farm?
Well, we are essentially, this farm has become a microcosm of the greater ecosystem of our planet. You know, we basically, it's based on the elements of biomimicry, and we're essentially imitating, you know, the biological relationships that exist to create a balanced system that prevent epidemics of pests and disease. And this farm is stacked, you know, vertically in the same way that a complex ecosystem is. And I think that sort of gives it the best, you know, comparison.
I'd like to start out for our listeners who, you know, haven't seen the film. I so love this film. It was so uplifting. And it's something I've been very interested in for the last several years, of getting away from the non-sustainable, extractive form of agriculture that our civilization has been favoring, and going to this rather, in a way, old-fashioned, you know, based on, you know, the old model of farming with lots of animals and, you know, kind of living in harmony with nature. But could you take us back to the beginning? At the beginning of the film, you adopt a dog named Todd. And as a person that owns rescue dogs myself, this is what just sucked me into this film right away. Tell us about Todd and how that, you know, led to you guys moving to this venture on a farm.
Well, first, you know, I think it's important to say that Molly and I had always had this dream, but we didn't quite have the courage, you know, to take the leap. And so Todd kind of enters into our life at a time when we're, you know, busy building our careers, and we've got our identity as like a filmmaker, and, you know, she's a private chef. And we made a promise to this dog who had been, you know, passed around from hoarder to shelter, et cetera, that we would never give up on him. And so when he started barking his head off, which led to us ultimately being, you know, evicted, we used that as like the courage to kind of make a big change in our life, you know, because just moving to another apartment wouldn't do. It would be this repeat. And so we used our promise to Todd as really the courage to kind of build this life on a farm and follow our dream. So he led us here.
And how did you discover this piece of property in Moore Park, California, which is, you know, just north of Los Angeles and east of Ventura? I know the area quite well because I grew up down there.
Oh, nice.
How did you discover this piece of property?
Well, you know, we looked around at a bunch of different farms, and this one actually had intact a tremendous amount of biodiversity already, just in the form of, you know, native and non-native old growth trees. And by trees, I don't mean orchard trees. I mean like sycamores and, you know, coast live oaks and valley oaks and things that were native to California. And that was a really important part because most of the farmland around here is completely void of any real diversity outside of the crop itself that they're growing. So it felt like the perfect place to at least start. But we didn't realize how incredibly void the soil was from, you know, to borrow your word, from these extractive methods that had been used here on this farm for 45 years. So we were starting from the beginning, really.
And then you meet this man, Alan York, who becomes your mentor in rebuilding the soils there. Can you tell us how did you meet him? Because he's just an amazing person.
When Molly and I were looking for, you know, guidance and like certification guidance, like what could we be certified that would communicate to the public that we were doing things in a way that were regenerative or ecologically restorative? We found a method called biodynamics. And through that organization, they had given us a few consultants who knew that space, and Alan was one of them. And so Molly found his information on the internet and reached out to him. And he had been traveling all over the world as a consultant in this way of farming to mostly vineyards. And, you know, when we finally convinced him to take us on, because it wasn't easy, he turned us down three times. It was classic, you know, classic story myth, right? And he finally came here and he was like, this is really the dream project because I've always wanted to try this on a farm that grew more than just grapes. And so it was really Molly who tracked him down.
When you did track him down, can you just kind of take us through when he took a look at this piece of property, what were the initial steps and guidances he gave you to try to turn this into what it's become today?
Well, the two, that's really a great question because it's the two less obvious and less fun details of what we thought we were doing. And we thought we were going to be growing food. He immediately looked at like the property and said, we need to get rid of 45% of what's growing here. You need to create more biodiversity. We need to also create culverts to direct the water that's coming from your neighbor's property that's full of maybe silt or sand and not being constructive to your property. And we need to make sure that it comes on and off your property in an orderly fashion while at the same time establishing cover crops just on the now sort of vacant land where we've taken out old orchard trees to rebuild and build the soil. So like for the first year and a half, it was like we weren't even really farming. We were really preparing this farm to be a place that once we built the soil, it would stay. And that was really hard to sort of feel patient about, but we were letting him be our guide.
Well, that brings me to a question that a good friend of mine, Jennifer Jewell, who has the program Cultivating Place, she asked me to ask you this, and then a few other people too, who I was telling about your wonderful project. And I hope you don't mind me asking this, but how do you go about financing something like this? Because, you know, it's a major undertaking. How did you go about the financial backing to have the patience to do this?
Well, it's a great question. And I find that most of the time when it's being asked, you know, I think people are also wondering, is this possible? Is regenerative farming an economically sustainable, you know, way forward? And so I'll answer it in a couple of ways. I think first and foremost, yes, regenerative agriculture, there are plenty of examples of farms that are working in an economically sustainable way. But to really get the full context of like what we're even asking ourselves about the economics of farming at all, we have to look at the, you know, 260 years that we have obliterated at least a third of our topsoil and wonder what are the economics of the sort of unconscious, I think up to this point, ramifications of farming in a non-regenerative way. A farm like this to become or to be sort of the model of economic sustainability, I think to answer that question, you have to like look at, well, we purchased a piece of land that had been extractively farmed for 45 years. So for us to build a soil system, a food growing system on soil that was dead, we had to first put money back in the bank because they robbed those nutrients in order to grow food cheaply because it costs money to regenerate land. So it took us 5 years before we could really even plant anything on this property to where it wasn't completely dependent upon us for every input. So I think we started 5 years behind, and you know, how we found the money for this. Well, we kept talking about our idea, and we, Molly and I also, especially Molly, being a traditional sort of food chef specializing in like the importance of nutrient dense food, knew the value of nutrient dense food and how little it was being grown and talked about. And we knew that it started with the soil. And we finally, because we talked it up so much, found some investors who looked at that as the future. Not only the ecological impact, but they really believed in the depth of flavor, the nutrient density of food, and that all starts and ends with the soil. And so that alignment has made it possible for us to do things on a timeline that maybe someone who didn't believe in those things would never see the value in. But what we've created through that is perhaps a long-term immune system that exists on this farm to withstand tests of various pests and disease pressures that many farms will face because of the biological complexity of it. We sequester tons of water. Like in the last year, 24 inches of rain, we were able to sequester 140 million gallons of water. We didn't lose topsoil. We didn't lose nutrients to runoff. You know, what's the value and economic sustainability of that? It's hard to tell over 3 years, but maybe in 10 or 20, there's some values that we haven't even accounted for with these methods.
And how long did it take before you kind of turned that corner to where the farm, Apricot Lane Farms, became, you know, something where you could really start to generate income out of it, and it started to really produce? What was the point you reached where it's like, okay, now we've reached that point where this farm is producing?
Well, you know, I often say like year five was the moment of truth for us. It's where we saw the regeneration of, or the return of, biodiversity that was now actually helping to solve problems for us. We saw the result of a 5-year egg study we had done on our pastured eggs, where we were doing a nutrient analysis and watched those numbers increase 3 to 5 times over the period of 5 years. And the only difference in that whole equation was it was the same food, the same feed source. We're using a organic, you know, soy-free, GMO-free feed from Modesto Mills. The only thing different about the way we were dealing with those chickens was the soil. The soil had improved, and therefore bugs, worms, and grasses growing from that soil that the chickens were eating on were eating that, and that was the informing the nutrient density of the eggs. And so suddenly we had something to really hang our hats on. And the trees were producing enough at year five that we were actually really able to create a more of a direct-to-consumer relationship on a more consistent basis with the right quantities.
And you know, you're a cinematographer, and this film is beautifully photographed, and just it's a wonderful film to watch. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Thank you.
It had me in tears at times, and at the end of it, I felt like, you know, this made me feel good to watch this film, and I kind of needed that. So I want to thank you for providing that for me as just an audience member. I can't imagine anyone watching this film and not feeling that uplift that comes from experiencing your film. And so my question is, did you decide right at the beginning, you know, that you're going to turn this farming project also into a documentary? When did you, you know, because I guess that would be natural as a cinematographer, but when did you decide that you were going to turn this into a documentary?
I'd quit the film business. It was 2009 that we started really kind of heading towards this. And there wasn't much going on in the film business. And I was kind of done. I wasn't inspired anymore. And when I got to the farm, I didn't know anything about whether or not this was going to work. And I didn't know, even if it did work, what was I to teach? So I was completely against the idea of saying I would ever do a film about this. But I had been shooting documentaries for long enough to know that it, like, also when things were interesting, I just captured them. And over the years, I would just pull literally an iPhone out or a GoPro. And then sometime along the way, I started, you know, pulling in more expensive cameras. And I was capturing things, but not knowing how it all fit together until year five. I saw this like sudden return of that biodiversity, purposeful wildlife, kind of like solving problems for us, you know, gopher snakes, badgers, and weasels eating our gophers that we were spending thousands of dollars trying to catch by, you know, with manpower. And I said, I think I'd accidentally been capturing all the players in this story. And so at year five, I made a commitment that I was going to, you know, find some additional funding and bring in some teams to really help me get some of the specialized shots that would help illustrate it in the most like cinematic way. Because when would a filmmaker ever spend 8 years of their life, you know, inside the engine of an ecosystem, living inside the engine of the story simultaneously, you know, being able to capture those rhythms that would repeat every year in such a way that would tell it unlike it had ever been told before. And I felt like, in a way, I kind of, for the how blessed I've been to be able to live this life, I feel like I kind of owed that back to people, to give them that lens.
If you're just joining us, our guest is John Chester. He and his wife, Molly, bought a 200-acre piece of farmland in Southern California and set out to turn it into an organic and biodynamic agricultural model for farming in harmony with the forces of nature. Their film, The Biggest Little Farm, chronicles their story. I'm Dave Schlom. You're listening to Blue Dot. We're going to take a short break, but we'll be right back. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's return now to our interview with filmmaker and farmer behind the new documentary, The Biggest Little Farm, John Chester. This film, it moved me. And you know, as soon as I heard about it from some friends who told me, you've got to see this film. You're going to love this because we know this is right up your alley. And then when I got to actually see it, I was enthralled. And I just want to thank you for making this. And I know that for all of our listeners, if you watch this film, you will enjoy it too. I guarantee that.
Well, can I add something to that? Because I feel like a lot of people who have watched the film feel like, you know, they say that they've needed this. And I feel like that need comes from, if I can sort of maybe project a bit here, I think as humans, we feel like the cancer of Earth, you know, and we feel like we are the ones who have done this damage, and we compare ourselves to cancer. And I don't think people really understand what cancer is, because, you know, cancer is a cell that has mutated and become immortal and replicates other cells that have the same immortal ability, where they never die and they only take nutrients from their host. But the thing is that cancer isn't aware of the fact that its death is imminent, with the death of the host, if that's what happens. And we as humans have this awareness for the dependency upon our host. So we aren't cancer, and we can't be cancer. What we've done that's cancer-like has been done unconsciously. You know, over the last 260 years, the destruction of a third of the topsoil and the 46% of the deforestation of the trees, and perhaps even the doubling of our CO2 numbers, has been done without a consciousness for our effect. When we're conscious, the human force of nature is incredibly powerful. And so we took a 45-year extractively farmed operation, and consciously, we turned it into something far better than what it was within 7 years. I think we're incredibly powerful, especially in our conscious state of that force of nature.
Yes, and Jennifer Jewell also pointed out to me that there's a term for what you're doing, and it's called permaculture. That what you're doing is very permanent; that it's going to last. It says it's truly sustainable. Have you ever heard that term before?
Yeah, and I don't actually think that's an appropriate term for this, because it's actually permaculture is a very specific and discipline of farming. We borrow from those permaculture techniques, but we, you know, we use holistic methods, we use regenerative methods, we use organic, we use biodynamic, but ultimately, and I know you didn't mean this or intend to mean this, because there's always like these battles between like permaculture or biodynamics or holistic. And I have this one view of philosophy on the farm, and that is that we will borrow from any element that the ecosystem and its 4.5 billion years of wisdom will impart to us. So we need to be open to what our ecosystem is telling us and utilize those methods. We don't want to get into wars over which way of farming is right. We should look at what the ecosystem needs, and we need to respond to it, you know, accordingly.
Thank you for saying that, because I frankly, this is, you know, I don't know much about those terms. Mm-hmm. And so I'm glad you explained that. And I don't know about permaculture, but I do know this, is that what you're doing is in harmony with your piece of land.
Right.
And your place on planet Earth. And that's working there for you. And I'd like to also ask you, you know, about this process of problem solving, because, you know, all farmers go through these, you know, you have to battle things like the climate and the weather. When you moved in there, that was during one of the longest and harshest droughts in recent California history, going back for a very long time. And so you're battling that. And then you had the pest problems with the snails attacking your fruit trees. And of course, coyotes attacking your chickens and all those, you know, the farmer's dilemma of kind of that battle you go on. And what was your problem solving process that, you know, because you definitely were able to solve these problems and work with nature on your farm?
That's a really good question. And I think it's probably the thing that's changed me the most is really how problem solving has changed both my wife and I. Because in the beginning, when we would, you know, have these failures, immediately the first reaction is like embarrassment, because you're surrounded by a team of people that are working with you. You know, if you're lucky enough to have a few volunteers and some full-time guys, and then you have your neighbors who are watching if your idealistic methods are working. So failure is followed by embarrassment. And the first thing you want to do is fix it to cover it. And there's a lot of energy spent in rushing to a fix and feeling shame. And what we learned is that the longer we took to fix something, where we actually sat back and allowed the shame and the embarrassment part just to be part of the process, the more deeply we were able to see these more substantial fixes, because we understood the problem better. We understood what fueled it. We understood the benefit of it and why it existed. And then we could figure out how to balance it the way the ecosystem balances things, which is not with just one solution, but many solutions. And they're each taking a little piece out of it to help bring it back into some stability. So I think, like, as a culture, I think what we've all become is, you know, very quick to be confrontators over innovators. And, you know, we don't like something. We don't like the way something's being said, or the way a corporation's dealing with something. We're not looking that a lot of these things exist because we've stopped innovating, and we've stopped promoting a culture of innovation because we see failure as something to shame people for. And for us to solve the problem of the ecosystem, we can't have people asking farms like this, well, will they feed the world? Because that is a far more complicated question to be answered only after we have stabilized, right, the re-innovation of soil, while at the same time growing food to feed our communities. So it's changed the way I see failure and, you know, embarrassment.
That really leads me to my next question, is that I'd like to know, you know, and I hope I'm not being too personal here, but I'd like to know, for you and your wife and your relationship and you guys personally, how has this experience changed you as a human being as well as a farmer?
I think, you know, one of the things that we couldn't cram into the film was, you know, some of the more difficult, darker conversations between a husband and a wife trying to sort out which way to go with problems that neither of us were the expert in. So these arguments were like these circles of go nowhere. And, I think it really, you know, the year three and four after the sort of untimely departure of a very important person on the farm that's in this story, it caused a lot of stress and it really threatened to break us down. And I got to tell you, we ultimately figured out that if we weren't able to evolve individually as a couple, that the ecosystem that we were trying to be stewards of was going to collapse. And it forced us into couples therapy, which I say now we have made it so our therapist can buy a summer home so that we get to live in one home. And I wouldn't trade the darkness that led us to there for the world, because I feel like it's made us so much better. And I have an appreciation for the importance of like what it means to really, really communicate and be vulnerable with a team of people, you know, that are trying to align to solve problems that none of them all have the answer for. So you have to be able to be really, you know, vulnerable in that space. And I would say humility ultimately has been the lesson that we've learned. You know, I heard Joel Salatin say it once. He said, you know, farming is about observation, creativity, followed by humility. And to that, I would add and repeat. It just keeps repeating.
Yes, I can see that. And I'm also very curious about your staff. Tell us a bit about the people that now work on your farm. You don't need to be like talk about individuals necessarily, but how many people work there and what kind of roles do they have? That, you know, how has this gone from you and Molly having this dream to now, you know, you've got to have a pretty good sized staff to be doing all the things you're doing with, you know, growing all this wonderful food and getting it out there and selling it in the market and taking care of all these animals. Can you tell us a bit about the staff there at the farm?
Sure. Like in the beginning, it was just Molly, myself. We had two full-time guys and nine volunteers through an organization called WOOF, which is Worldwide Opportunity on Organic Farms. And that's kind of how we built the first couple of years. And then after time went on, a lot of those woofers ended up becoming full-time employees, some of which are still here today after, you know, 7-8 years. And the actual agricultural operation of the farm is probably under 20 people. And then at year 4 and 5, when we started to sort of see like the proof of concept, then we went back to our investors and it was sort of a unanimous decision that we could do a lot more if we had market staff to kind of run the farmers markets and, you know, then delivery truck drivers to deliver direct to retail, because we were then making 3 times more than we were selling to a packing house. So over the years, we've really increased the number of people just based on market and sales. And then now we're even doing, you know, added value product. For a farm like us, it's important that there's zero waste. So like, what do we do if we aren't able to sell all the lemons at picking time? Well, now we make a bourbon lemon marmalade and other things like that. It's cool though. The farm is like 7 farms in 1, right? We grow 250 things. So we've got a livestock team that is integrated within the orchard team. So we've got an orchard team. We've got a garden team that does ground crops. We've got a fertility team, like 2 people, that basically make compost and compost tea all day long. And that is really the building the immune system and the fertility of our land. And then we've got, you know, a couple guys on irrigation, and we're sort of stacking all these different enterprises on top of each other, from livestock, poultry, garden, orchards. So it's a very efficient 214 acres growing 250 things. So when you look at the size of number of people it takes to run 7 farms in 1, it does start to get up there.
Wow. And you mentioned earlier a term, biodynamic, and I know, you know, there's organic certified. Can you tell us about, you know, what's the process you had to go through to get those kinds of, you know, certifications?
Sure.
Because, you know, that's a big deal when people want to buy your produce and your meats and your fruits. You know, they want to make sure that it's, you know, certified organic. Can you tell us a bit about, you know, what was the process like going through to get that, especially the biodynamic thing? If you could explain that to us, I'd really appreciate that.
Sure. And let me first say that, like, you know, certification, I don't believe certification is a requirement in determining whether or not a farm is a good steward of the land and growing really great tasting nutrient dense food. I think, you know, as consumers get, you know, smarter, they can ask farmers the right questions to determine if they align with their beliefs. But for us, we decided to become certified because we didn't have a reputation and we were also looking for guidance. So in the future, I mean, I intend to be certified, but you never know, like it may become also a hindrance to us. It takes a lot of time and paperwork. So this is the way it breaks down, at least in our case. In order to become biodynamically certified, you first have to become organically certified. Since the farm had been farmed conventionally for 45 years, we had to wait that 3-year period of not using synthetically derived pesticides or chemically derived fertilizers. After that 3-year mark, then you're eligible for biodynamics. And that's really about creating and building the soil system on your farm. You're restoring wildlife habitats. You're composting. You're using compost teas. You're building soil fertility. You're using cover crops. You know, there's lots of different methods that you're shooting towards to ultimately try to create a closed loop system where you're bringing less and less inputs from the outside to fertilize your soils. So having animal programs here to utilize the manure and the beautiful nitrogen rich elements of, you know, duck manure and chicken manure and all those other things that go into help feeding soil systems that feed plants that grow food. So biodynamics really looks at the whole farm as like an ecosystem. And there's other methods of farming that do the same thing, like regenerative, which we're also heading towards a regenerative certification. They just offer different pathways to kind of get there.
I see. And I'm glad you explained that to me, because I find that fascinating, that what you said about, you know, perhaps it's not so important having that certification if you just actually know the farmer and how they practice on their land. For me personally, that would be more important than a label.
There you go. And that's why I made the film, because I wanted to give people a bit more of a lens with which to look at, like, the value of regenerative farming. Like, here's the thing. Not many people know that the organic certification, has no requirement for the preservation and regeneration of healthy soil. None. It only says you can't use synthetically derived sprays, like pesticides that are synthetic, or chemical fertilizers. So the problem is that we're facing right now, more than anything, is the loss of topsoil and the lack of nutrients that are in our food that lead to degenerative diseases. And I think we're moving more towards a culture that wants to be preemptive in their healthcare. It's not enough to eat an apple. It's the important that the apple you're eating actually has nutrients in it. And so soil is the way to that. And along the way of building healthy soil, you solve all these other problems, right? I mean, atmospheric carbon, for one, it requires a tremendous amount of carbon to be sequestered into the ground when you're growing cover crops. I can tell you the numbers if you want them.
Yeah, and that fascinates me because carbon sequestration is so important right now with what we're dealing with climate change. And your farm, you know, for its little tiny piece of this planet, is doing a tremendous amount for that.
Yeah. So like, for example, like we've increased soil organic matter levels on this farm 3% in the last 7 years. So some of our pastures are anywhere from 6 to even 11% in soil organic matter, which is incredible, but we've added 3%. And just to give you like, the value of that 3%, simply a 1% increase in soil organic matter per acre requires the drawdown of 21 tons of atmospheric carbon, right? In addition, that 1% soil organic matter has the ability to hold between 16,000 and 20,000 gallons of water per acre in the top 12 inches of soil. So there's so many other like indirect, in our mind, from the food growing part, indirect benefits beyond just the food to farming in this way. Because essentially what we're doing is we're mimicking the restorative processes that ecosystems try themselves to do after we've maybe destroyed them. We're just mimicking those processes, and those processes heal the immune system of our planet, which is the ecosystem.
You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlom. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with John Chester, the filmmaker and farmer behind the new documentary, The Biggest Little Farm. Stay with us. Let's return now to our interview with John Chester. His new film, The Biggest Little Farm, chronicles the story of he and his wife Molly, along with their staff and friends, in rehabilitating the 200-acre Apricot Lane Farms in Moorpark, California. Can you tell us a little bit about, like, okay, when you started this project, what was your level of understanding about soil science and the way soils work compared to where you are now?
I only had the sort of children's book version of what this farm could be. And I knew that there was value in the health supportive elements of it to the animals. I didn't really understand the complexities of soil. And I honestly, I kind of owe that to Molly, because the thing that really opened my mind to it was when I started learning about the gut microbiome, you know. And I, 30 some years old, I kind of was going through some health issues where I just was feeling terrible. I wasn't even aware that you were supposed to eat and feel your food. Like, you would actually feel energy from food in a way that was healthy. So I started going through this process of understanding how, you know, messed up my gut was. And in that process, when I started learning about soil, it's the same thing. And so it was like an epiphany for me that I was able to visualize what I needed to do for the soil in the same way that I helped sort of my own gut microbiome. And then it was like, I was completely convinced, because I had this very, intimate experience with my own gut. So I was able to believe completely in the methods and the approaches that I was using to try to build back the gut of the soil. And I always say failure and terror is an incredible motivator. I mean, you can learn how to do a lot of things under pressure if your life is dependent on it. And as things were falling apart and not working, I became a reader and a lifeline caller to every farmer that would ever talk to me about any of this stuff before, you know, so that I could figure it out, because I realized that we were going to not be able to succeed if I couldn't figure out and understand and appreciate how to build soil in the fastest, most efficient way possible.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlom, and we're talking to John Chester. He's the filmmaker behind the new documentary, The Biggest Little Farm, about Apricot Lane Farms in Moorpark, California, in Southern California. And that statement you just made about calling other farmers, can you just tell us a bit about, you know, what's it been like for you interacting with other farmers to get advice? Are they pretty, you know, open and trying to be helpful? And how do you sift through all of that advice?
Well, it's, you know, we have a lens, you know, Molly and I have a very specific lens in which and how we look at what we do. And, you know, we see that there's infinite potential for collaboration with an ecosystem. And we try to seek out farmers that, you know, are running their farms in the same way. And when you find those guys and women, you find an ally who appreciates and has an empathy for your struggles, and they want to help and they want to pass on the lore. If you talk to maybe an industrialized farmer who is closed off to this way and, you know, feels threatened by it or doesn't want to see it, then you're obviously not going to get the help. You're going to get the skepticism and, you know, maybe even a lot of the fear. and risks associated with this. So it's been amazing because when we do find those people that are at least open to it, they're immense teachers and they're fantastic mentors. And there's been a number of them along the way that have crossed our paths that we've called on in those really desperate times, and I think it's really cool to know that that kind of network is actually out there if you seek it out and if you have the right lens with which to look at your problem.
Could you tell us maybe about a couple of them that really stand out to you that have been incredibly helpful?
Yeah. So one that comes to mind is a farmer named Farmer Al, who runs a farm up in Brentwood, California called Frog Hollow. And he's a guy that, started his farm on, a couple of maxed out credit cards. And when he was probably, I think he was like in his 20s and he's in his 70s now. And he's just incredibly knowledgeable and he grows a huge diversity of stone fruit and he's created his own direct relationship with consumers. And he just loves what he does and he believes that there's a lot of potential that exists already right there on his land to solve problems. And so you see someone like him being successful financially, and that's really exciting. And of course, Alan York, our first mentor who came here and made us feel like this was possible. And there's holistic veterinarians that I've talked to along the way.
Yeah, because you also, we've been talking a lot about soil and plants, but you also have the same philosophies, with animals.
Yeah, I think, animals are an important component to build healthy soil. And, we're meat eaters here. And I think that as, a farmer, knowing that that animal is going to ultimately make that sacrifice for you and become food, that, we owe it a great deal of reverence and making sure that it lives in an environment that as closely as possible mimics a system where in nature it would be found, say, before farming. And I find that to be, at least for me, to be a very meaningful connection to the soil and food system, where I'm able to show reverence in every day that I wake up and care for those animals and create the healthiest pastures for them to live on. I think there's no better form of reconnection than understanding how we as a steward fit into the piece of growing food in harmony with the land.
Yeah, and we talked about your evolution and your understanding of the soil and how that all works, and that's amazing. But I'm also curious, I would imagine that as someone who's had to care for your animals now for these years, you've probably become a lot more expert in veterinary care, haven't you?
Yeah, I've been lucky enough to have a few vets that, have taught me a few things, and YouTube is a great place to learn how to suture. You can learn a lot of things on YouTube, but I think, more than anything, we do obviously most everything on the farm here without a vet, unless it gets into a C-section type thing. But really the thing that I think I value and have learned the most is the, preemptive healthcare and really making sure that we're looking at the gut microbiome of every animal and making sure that it is functioning at the highest level possible, because they can overcome a lot of things that many confined animals would literally, die from. Stress combined with a little bit of a sniffle could turn into pneumonia pretty quickly in an animal that's confined. But if we're looking after their preemptive needs, it's really great. You watch the resiliency of these animals expand, from one generation to the next.
Yeah. And is there maybe, what's one tip you would give to somebody who's caring for farm animals out there? If you're going to give them one thing that you've learned that's really valuable, what would it be?
Well, aside from making sure that herbivores are grazing on grass, I would say, we use things like apple cider vinegar in the water, one cup per 10 gallons, because that feeds the prebiotics that exist in their rumen for no other reason other than to break down grass and turn it into an energy source for them. So we're always looking at helping the microorganisms of that fermentation tank. And So we use things like apple cider vinegar. We'll even do free choice minerals. And even to help with parasite control, we'll let them nibble on diatomaceous earth, which is a, you know, essentially a, I think it's like a sea crustacean that's been ground up, but it's
those are the leftover silicates from marine organisms from basically plankton, some from microscopic marine organisms. Yeah,
exactly.
And they have a marvelous filtration property to them.
Right, and in their minuscule sort of scale, they're shards of glass to parasites, but they don't hurt the animal that's ingesting the diatomaceous earth as like, you know, what they think is like kind of a tasty mineral mix. So we do those types of things. And, you know, we don't have to use chemical dewormers on our farm. It's funny. No one ever asks us about that. People only ask about antibiotics. Mm. No one ever asks about the use of chemical dewormers.
Worms.
And those are pretty, I mean, that gets in the meat. That's pretty severe stuff. We don't use it because we use a lot of different holistic methods preemptively, you know, to keep those parasite levels at a level that would never harm that animal.
Wow. Well, that's interesting. Well, I would like to switch gears to talk about your incredible partner, your wife, Molly, because she's a chef, right?
Yeah. And, you know, this was Molly's dream to essentially just have a farm where she could grow every ingredient she cooked with. As ridiculous as that sounds, that's what led us here, because we grow pretty much every ingredient that she could ever cook with. And, you know, Molly's got this incredibly optimistic view on, you know, our pursuit. Like, she knew from the beginning that it may be difficult, but we'd eventually figure out a way. And I kind of, honestly, through the, even just editing the film, I realized that I wasn't actually as optimistic as her. And as much as I would have liked to have thought I was like also right there with her leading this charge of we can do it, I kind of questioned everything. I think because I also didn't want to feel like it wasn't true, you know? I wanted to believe that this fantasy could be real. But Molly has the ability to really sort of stay in that moment. I call her a hummingbird, and I feel like she's high on this invisible nectar that no one else can find.
I'm just imagining that you probably have some incredible meals that you can get prepared that are, you know, completely sourced from your property.
Yeah, it's funny, and you start to realize things like cauliflower actually has a taste.
Mm-hmm.
Think about that, because I never thought it did. But like, grown right in the right soil, people will talk about the taste and flavor of cauliflower. And that to me is like one of those indicator, it's like one of those indicator vegetables of like, if you got really good soil, even the cauliflower will taste good. You know, and that's what's great about Molly too, is like, she's always believed that it really starts with the ingredients and how those ingredients are grown. And that's why she knew that for her to find the best food, she had to find the best farmers who had the best soil, you know, and that's the thing she keeps bringing it all back to for, you know, for me and for us, is that, you know, we'll know when the soil's right, when the food's tasting good.
And going forward, is it your hope that this film and your farm and the example that you're setting and your success there will lead to other little big farms?
Absolutely.
Big little farms, I should
yeah,
say.
Yeah, little big farms. No, I look, we're the, you know, our planet is the biggest little farm of quite possibly the universe. As far as we know, we may never, ever in our lifetime ever find another planet that can produce its own food and support as much life as this one. And I think our goal as individuals on this planet is, you know, not to change the world. It's to change our patch of it. And I hope that the film empowers people to think about what they can do right there in their own yard or on their small farm, and know that that's enough. Because the way we're going to really change anything is through a patchwork quilt. And it's only going to be replicated when people see it working. And that should be the goal. Make your piece work, you know? And know that, I hope, what people are inspired to see is that it's possible to have a collaborative relationship with a system like the ecosystem that has had a 4.5 billion year head start on us on how to solve problems. And there's so little we actually know about how it does it. And that to me is endlessly fascinating.
Well, we talked about your dear friend, Alan York, who was your mentor in this project, who passed away. If he could look at what's going on now, what do you think he would say to you, and what would he think about what's happening on that piece of property?
I think Alan would be incredibly proud that he was able to pass on what he did before he left this earth, because it was always a frustration for him. He said that so much knowledge and he never could find the time to write the book, and he apparently, according to him, even started it. And I feel like we've taken so much of his wisdom and encouragement that we didn't even understand at the time, you know, and we've adapted it all over time. And I just really wish he could have seen it, because I know how proud he would have been for the part that he played in encouraging us to go as far as we did.
Well, John Chester, I want to thank you so much for spending this time with us on Blue Dot and telling us about your little corner of our planet, because it's a special, special place. And thank you for making it so.
Thank you so much for your interest and encouragement. I appreciate it.
Thanks again to our guest, John Chester, filmmaker, farmer, and partner to his best friend and wife, Molly, along with Emma the Pig, Greasy the Rooster, and their dear departed friends, Alan York and Todd the Dog. You know, when I started watching this film, it was the story of Todd the Rescue Dog that roped me in, because my best friends, Pearl, Elvis, and Ellie, are also rescue dogs. Every Sunday, we take them for a walk by the Sacramento River and pass through the wonderful native plant garden at the Sacramento River Discovery Center. We bought a few native plants there recently and planted them in and around our organic garden at home. Watching The Biggest Little Farm and talking to John Chester made me realize that we can do a lot with our little pieces of this planet. Thanks also to our good friend and colleague Jennifer Jewell from Cultivating Place, which is also produced by North State Public Radio and, like this show, distributed through PRX. You can check out this and past episodes at mynspr.org, or better yet, subscribe to us. Our podcast is on the NPR One app, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Mr. Matt Fidler. And our assistant producer and owner of a rescue dog named Rocket is Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.